From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. The Senate hearing to confirm Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett is well into its third contentious day. Yesterday, senators questioned her for 11 hours in a marathon session, and today could go just as long.
All week, Democrats have been trying to draw attention to Judge Coney Barrett's record and writings on abortion and the Affordable Care Act, while Republicans have praised her intellect and conservative credentials. Here's the Judiciary Committee Chair, Republican Lindsey Graham, earlier today.
This is the first time in American history that we've nominated a woman who's unashamedly pro-life and embraces her faith without apology, and she's going to the court.
Well, for the latest on day three of the hearings, we're joined by NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Robin.
And we should say Lindsey Graham is in a tough re-election battle himself. He may have been speaking more to voters, but Coney Barrett has been tight-lipped about how she would rule on issues like abortion. And today she said it was so she could maintain judicial independence. She's been saying this. Let's listen.
A judge needs to have an open mind every step of the way. So as I said, I've changed my mind at oral argument even after reading the briefs. I've changed my mind at conference after consulting with my colleagues. So if I were to just say how I thought I would resolve a case just because I saw the issue, it would be short-circuiting that whole process through which I should go and have an open mind and be open to persuasion.
And Carrie, Supreme Court nominees usually take this position during questioning. Do you think Coney Barrett tipped her hand in other ways today?
You know, she has largely been sticking to this idea of no hints, no previews, no forecasts. Yesterday, we heard her talk about how Roe v. Wade, the landmark abortion rights ruling, was not, in her view, a super precedent, something that had been so accepted that it could not be challenged. And today, she did give us one clue, Robin. She said, when you're evaluating as a judge a statute with many parts, a law with many parts, the presumption is that even if one part is unconstitutional, the presumption is the judge will try to save the remainder of the statute. That could be a hint as to how she may rule if she's confirmed and does hear that Affordable Care Act case before the High Court November 10th.
Well, Democrats continue to grill her about the Affordable Care Act. They pointed to past statements she made criticizing Justice Roberts' rulings on the law. So how does she deflect these charges? She's already made up her mind. I mean, as Lindsey Graham said, she's going to the court. And the Affordable Care Act will be before the court November 10th, right after the election.
Right after the election, some Democrats are arguing the reason Republicans are rushing this process is so she will be on the bench in order to help decide that third challenge the Supreme Court will hear on the law known as Obamacare. What Coney Barrett says is that all of these writings that people are pointing to, all of these statements by her, came when she was a law professor at Notre Dame, not on the bench, that she has not looked at the facts of this specific challenge coming before the court in early November, and that she has an open mind about the ACA, that she made no promises or commitments to anybody in the Senate or anybody in the White House about this. She says she is not going to be a pawn.
We heard Senator Graham also say that there's an effort by some in the liberal world to marginalize the contribution of women conservatives. I mentioned his tough re-election battle right now. Why do you think Republicans are playing this up?
Well, this is a nominee who would be taking the place or filling the shoes to some degree of liberal icon, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You saw, as did I, many thousands of women, more than thousands, and the outpouring of grief for Justice Ginsburg when she died recently. Amy Coney Barrett has some big shoes to fill in this regard. I will point out, as you have, that this is an election year, that President Trump, according to the polls, has been losing support from white suburban women around the country. And I think that this is coming up in that context right now.
Well, I also want to mention that the Democrat, Patrick Leahy, I'll synopsize it. He questioned her about voting rights, saying, are you aware communities of color disproportionately face restrictions and obstacles? And she said, I wasn't aware of the statistics you're citing to me. If it becomes relevant in any case, litigated before me and presented to me, I'd have an open mind about it. Odd she wouldn't be aware of those statistics. Many are. But what do you make of that?
She has wanted to avoid stepping on any hot-button political issues, especially ones that could come before the court. She may be, if she's confirmed, be expected to help decide an election-related challenge. And I think she was being very cautious here, Robin.
Yeah. Carrie Johnson, NPR's Justice Correspondent. Thank you.
My pleasure.
One of the most consequential elections in the country is the race for district attorney in Los Angeles County. And at the heart of it is the push for police reform. The incumbent Jackie Lacey is running against former San Francisco district attorney George Gascon. And both candidates are Democrats, but have starkly different views. There's also a lot of money going into this race, more than $12 million, including $1.5 million to the Gascon campaign from billionaire investor George Soros. For more, we're joined by Libby Denkman, senior politics reporter for KPCC. Welcome, Libby.
Hi, Tanya. Good to be here.
Yes. So the Los Angeles DA is the largest prosecutor's office in the country, and it's responsible for shaping the city's approach to criminal justice. And Lacey and Gascon are really starkly different candidates. I mean, Lacey has drawn a lot of support from police unions. Gascon is pitching himself as a progressive reformer. Let's start with Jackie Lacey, who is seeking a third term. What is she running on?
Sure. So Jackie Lacey has been a career prosecutor. She really came up within the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. She was the protege of the prior DA, and she was seen as the heir apparent for some years. And Lacey calls herself a reasonable reformer. She says she has instituted a mental health diversion program and really wants to keep community safety front and center while also following steady reforms. Now, George Gascon would say the reform have not come soon enough, and that Lacey is, in fact, in the pocket of Los Angeles police unions.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about George Gascon. He's a former police officer and a former San Francisco DA. He's campaigning on change and reform, but what exactly is he hoping to change?
Well, Gascon was the co-author of a statewide bill called Proposition 47, which downgraded some nonviolent felonies to misdemeanors. And that has led, along with some other issues of reform that were passed statewide in recent years, that has led to a drop in the jail population statewide. So he wants to continue this pattern of reducing incarceration, finding ways to divert people to either substance abuse programs or mental health diversion. He says that Black and brown men are disproportionately affected by our criminal justice system and our jails, which of course is borne out by data. Things like gang enhancements that he says are based on faulty data. And that also has been borne out by recent events in Los Angeles. Gang enhancements, of course, are additional enhanced charges that can be added on to somebody's sentence because they are a member of a gang. But in Los Angeles, multiple police officers now are facing charges for falsifying gang data into the CalGang database. Los Angeles County now can't even access the CalGang database anymore because field officers were saying that certain people they stopped were members of gangs when they simply weren't.
Well, with Lacey, though, I do remember that the Black Lives Matter movement and others were really critical of her tenure. Can you explain a little bit about why and who actually supports her? You mentioned that the police union supports her.
Yes, it's interesting. You see Jackie Lacey signs when you go to the suburbs of L.A., like San Marino. I was there over the weekend, which is near Pasadena. You'll see signs supporting her reelection. And then as you move west into the center of Los Angeles proper, you see way more George Gascon support. Jackie Lacey has been protested regularly by Black Lives Matter and other community groups in Los Angeles for what they see as her failure to prosecute police officers who kill Black men and Latino men in Los Angeles. She has only prosecuted one law enforcement officer, a sheriff's deputy, during her time in office, her 8 years in office. And Lacey says she follows the law and only pursues cases that she believes she can win. However, these activists say she has failed to step up and actually hold police officers accountable.
You know, another thing I'm wondering is, why did so many politicians withdraw support from Lacey in favor of Gascon? And do you expect to see more of that?
Everything that's happened with our racial reckoning in this country has just brought voters to really turn their head and look and see these weekly protests that have been going on for years by Black Lives Matter in front of Jackie Lacey's house. And all of this has just coalesced at a time when We are seeing this nationwide push for more progressive prosecutors to be elected in cities like Chicago and Philadelphia. This has been a goal of progressive reformers to really shift the narrative, shift policy from the top down. And you can't get bigger than this Los Angeles DA's office. I mean, this truly would be the gem in the crown of these progressive activists who are saying enough is enough. We have to start looking at reforms, at ways to divert people from the criminal justice system. And that has coincided with the national attention and voters' attention really turning to these issues.
That's KPCC senior politics reporter Libby Dankman. Thank you so much for this update.
Thanks, Tanya.
A day after President Trump was diagnosed with COVID-19, some 100 cars gathered in Massachusetts for a Trump train of support. WBUR reporter Quincy Walters captured voices from that day, including two we wanted to hear again. Let's start with Anne Ragosta of Milford, Massachusetts.
When he comes out of this, it's going to be like a phoenix rising out of the ashes, because he's strong, he's mentally strong, he's emotionally strong, he's spiritually strong, he's morally strong.
Anne is a former federal agent with three daughters. She joins us now. And since his illness, President Trump has been holding rallies without social distancing or mask requirements. He got special care, but hundreds of thousands have died. Are you still an ardent supporter?
He has my 100% support. That hasn't wavered. I believe, I don't think that he dismisses masks. I think his philosophy from a federal governing standpoint is let the states decide how they want to administer COVID remedies, and that includes masks. He certainly isn't opposed to masks. I think he's handled, again, from a federal perspective, he has implemented Operation Warp Speed to remove roadblocks or, bureaucratic and administrative roadblocks from working on vaccines and therapeutics, which is huge for this country. I mean, bureaucratic roadblocks slows things down tremendously for people. And I think the president understands that when China released this virus to our country, he understands that viruses cannot be eradicated. They need to be managed. And they're managed through therapeutics, and they're managed through vaccines. And I think that's really what he's working towards.
Well, first, U.S. intelligence does not believe China purposefully released the virus. Many Chinese died. But I want to stay with masks. At the rally, you didn't wear one. What about the notion it's not for you, it's for someone else? It's like a seatbelt. If we wear them, we bring down emergency room visits, the cost of health care, fewer people die. I mean, the country often asks people to do things for the good of everyone, right?
Yeah, and I guess it depends where you fall on the spectrum of collectivism, right? I mean, I can be responsible for my own health. My not wearing a mask shouldn't impact you. I'm not forcing you to come near me. I'm not forcing you to come within 6 feet of me. People that choose to wear a mask near me, I totally, support that. Again, I think it depends where you fall on the spectrum of individual and personal responsibility for my own self versus the collective. And I just, when it comes to masks, again, people, everyone can choose to stay away from me if I'm not wearing a mask and if they think that masks work.
Yeah, I have to stop you there, because in the beginning they said, please don't run out and buy them because we need masks for first line responders. And then they weren't quite sure. But then the evidence came in. It's overwhelming. We just have to have said that. It's overwhelming that masks and other mitigation like social distancing will at least slow down. And they say something like 100,000 more people could live rather than die.
I think the mitigation, I think people can choose their own levels of mitigation.
What is it about President Trump, or is it a Republican platform? I mean, what is your strongest drive for voting for President Trump?
Sure. So let me just preface that by when Donald Trump came on the presidential scene, I had no preconceived notions about him. I just knew he was a famous hotel and casino businessman. But I listened to him, and I liked what I heard. And what I've come to realize about the president is he believes and fights for the protection of our civil liberties and our economic freedoms by limiting the powers of the central government. And I think it's his faith and belief in our Constitution that informs all those decisions that he's made for us.
And what do you think? I mean, your party has divisions in it, so does the Democratic Party. But what do you think? There are Republicans who think that this is just crazy that, you know, he's taking the party down.
Well, I think clearly he's not taking the party down. I think that candidates who supported him strongly did very well and got reelected. I would say 90% of Republicans do not think that he's, in fact, has strengthened the party. And I don't think our divide is that deep. And I think if you look at the majority of Republicans, they would say that the Republicans that do not like Donald, you know, I think it's different between not liking Donald Trump's personality and not liking his policies. I would challenge anyone who does not like, who's a Republican that doesn't like Donald Trump. I think if you deconstructed how they felt about his policies, I think you would find that they support his policies, but they can't get past his personality.
Anne Rigosta, a Trump supporter from Milford, Massachusetts. Anne, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Well, now let's turn to Katherine Johnson. She pulled up to that Trump rally that Anne was at just to see what was going on. Here was her reaction.
If he is able to rally his supporters like this, with everything he is talking about, the fraudulent election, the coronavirus, the racial unrest, I feel like we're a tweet away from civil war.
Katherine was once a staunch New Hampshire Republican. Her father, William Johnson, was head of the GOP in New Hampshire. He led the state Senate, eventually became a state Supreme Court justice. Katherine recently left the GOP and became an independent. She joins us now. And Katherine, we just heard your fears, but still, why did you leave this party your family loved so much?
Well, first, I would say that I do not recognize the Republican Party of even 4 years ago, Robin. 2016 was the 50th anniversary of my father's run for the U.S. Senate. In honor of my father, I devoted a year of my life to attend over 140 campaign events in New Hampshire and around the country. I actually worked for Governor Chris Christie. I never heard any of this talk. Immigration, I mean, the wall. I would not be a party to this party ever again. They've sold their souls to Donald Trump. Robin, I bought plywood to board up my windows. I have all my important documents in a safety deposit box. I have weeks worth of supplies like I was going to be in a hurricane, because I literally don't know what the United States is going to look like after November 3rd. I have never been so scared in my entire life.
Oh, well, what are you talking about? Are you talking about people with arms taken to the streets?
Well, we saw it in Portland. We saw it in Kenosha. They're hailing Kyle Rittenhouse a hero. I am the mother of a 29-year-old daughter. I come from a very privileged white community. I am now the grandmother of two black grandsons, and I fear for their safety in Houston, Texas, after the election. I mean, really, I'm a news addict, and I literally spend my day trying to tell my Republican friends the facts. But I completely understand why they voted for Donald Trump in 2016. He really is a fantastic con man.
Well, just, you know, take coronavirus. How do you feel? I mean, how do you feel about, for instance, how masks have been politicized?
Robin, I mean, how many interviews have you done? The one I heard, the Democratic convention, was the only pre-existing condition my father had was trusting Donald Trump?
Katherine, I just have to ask, it's obvious your feelings about Donald Trump. What do you think your father would say?
I visited his grave yesterday, and I feel like he was rolling over in it. I mean, my father worked with the greats, Nelson Rockefeller and George Romney. I miss my dad every day, but I'm so grateful he's not seeing what's done, oh, especially to the judicial system. My father was a Supreme Court justice. He believed good men and women needed to forego making money because they had such an important role to play. He said that if there was only one thing written about him, that his proudest accomplishments were working across the aisle to get things done for the people of New Hampshire. His dying wish was to be able to do more for them after he retired. I wasn't allowed to be involved in politics my whole life because of the appearance of impropriety. That is not a term Donald Trump has ever uttered in his life. I'm a really happy person and really optimistic about the future, but I'm scared for our country. The mask issue, if Donald Trump had told his supporters to wear masks, hundreds of thousands of people would be alive today. And when he got COVID, I got hope. I didn't want him to get sick, but I hoped he'd learn. But no, he gets airlifted to Walter Reed and experimental medications for compassionate care. Where's his compassion for the 215,000 people who've lost their lives? He is my president, but I do not respect him.
Well, we did not know this would be this emotional for you. These are tense times for many, but we thank you. That's Katherine Johnson, her family, longtime Republicans from New Hampshire. She is now rejecting the party. And we also spoke with Andrew Gosta, a staunch Trump supporter. Katherine, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a real pleasure. And I'd like to say I really do respect the opinion of the other caller. We have differing views, but I bet if we met and we didn't know, we might even be friends.
Just two voices. We're going to try to hear as many as possible from along the political spectrum before Election Day.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology, with over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience. Join a virtual info session on Wednesday, October 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
And while Democrats and Republicans in the Senate Judiciary Committee battle over Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court, a parallel tussle is happening on television airwaves and digital platforms as liberal and conservative groups alike spend millions of dollars on advocacy ads. Joining us with the details here now, media analyst John Carroll. John, I've started to notice this. For how big are these Supreme Court advertising campaigns?
They're pretty big. I mean, in the 10 days after Justice Ginsburg died, about $2 million worth of television ads ran. But since then, there's real money involved at this point. Mm-hmm. By my count, there are seven conservative groups that have committed to spending about $25 million on this fight. There are six liberal groups that are looking to spend about $12 million opposing the Barrett nomination. And I should point out that most of these groups are dark money groups, which means we don't know who their donors are. So these are pretty much anonymous attacks and support.
Well, on the liberal side, the biggest player is the dark money group Demand Justice. They've been in previous court battles.
Yeah, they spent $5 million opposing Brett Kavanaugh's nomination in 2018. This time around, the group says it will spend $10 million. It's currently running ads nationally and in selected states, accusing the Republicans of rushing to play politics with the court amid the pandemic.
Yeah, and Planned Parenthood Vote, that's the political arm of the healthcare group, is running ads that feature Justice Ginsburg. Let's listen.
An American icon, a champion of women's rights. Donald Trump wants to replace her, against her dying wish, with another Supreme Court justice threatening coverage for pre-existing conditions and reproductive freedom.
That pretty well summarizes the liberals' main argument against the Barrett nomination. There are also several groups running footage of Mitch McConnell opposing Barack Obama's Merrick Garland nomination in 2016.
You know, it's clear two can play this game. On the conservative side, a dark money group called 45 Committee running an ad that quotes Ginsburg herself. Here's how that ad starts.
How do you respect Ruth Bader Ginsburg? Remember her wise words on Supreme Court nominees in an election year.
The president is elected for 4 years, not 3 years, so the power that he has in year three continues into year four.
Others agreed.
Ginsburg made that statement in an address to incoming Georgetown law students in 2016 in the context of McConnell's efforts to freeze the Garland nomination. She also said maybe members of the Senate will wake up and appreciate that that's how it should be. But she conceded that the Senate can't be forced to act.
Yeah. Look, or forced not to act. You know, the Republican side in this case forced not to act in the case of Barrett. And that brings me to, why is all this money being spent on what seems like a done deal? Is it just to get out more political talking points?
Well, part of it is to sway public opinion, but what's not a done deal are the Senate races that'll be decided on November 3rd. It's no accident that a lot of these ads on both sides are running in some of the most tightly contested states, Arizona, Colorado, Iowa, North Carolina, Maine. That's generally where the biggest return of investment might come.
John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now, thank you.
Thank you.
The number of people voting this season is already shattering records. For instance, Wisconsin reports that nearly 720,000 people have already cast their votes early, and that's just half the number of those who have requested mail-in ballots. And in other places like Georgia and Texas, where in-person voting has started, long lines and legal battles are emerging. And for more, let's bring in Miles Parks, who covers voting for NPR's Washington desk. Hi, Miles.
Hi there.
So more than 13 million Americans have already cast their ballots in their respective states through early voting. Can you give us some perspective on how unprecedented these numbers are compared to years past?
Sure. It's really hard to overstate how unprecedented they are, really. I mean, more than five times as many voters have cast their ballots at this point than as had cast their ballots in 2016, according to a data analysis from the data firm Target Smart. And then if you dig into that analysis a little bit deeper, some other trends also emerge. Nine times as many African-American voters have voted at this point in the election cycle as had voted in 2016, and more than double the amount of first-time voters. You know, when you look at the whole picture, overall, some states are already up to a fifth or a quarter of their total 2016 turnout. That's not a quarter or a fifth of their total early vote total from 2016. That's a fifth or a quarter of their entire vote total of 2016 already, you know, in mid-October.
Wow. Okay. So let's talk about some of the challenges in that, because in some states, it seems like this record early voting, particularly by mail, could be a problem. Your reporting actually found that in two-thirds of states, election officials are allowed to start counting these ballots now as they come in. But in some states, they have to wait until election day. Are states going to be able to handle receiving far more mail-in ballots than they're used to?
They are going to be able to handle it. It might just take some more time. The states we're going to be watching really closely are Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. These are three states that are obviously pivotal for President Trump's reelection chances. And they're also states where officials cannot start this labor-intensive process of counting absentee ballots until on election day or close to it. You know, in Michigan, the legislature just passed a law that allows officials to start some of that work the Monday before, as in, you know, 24 hours before. But in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, there's been no change. You know, absentee ballots take a lot longer to count than in-person votes because officials have to open envelopes, they have to take out secrecy sleeves. It might sound simple, but, you know, when you scale it up to tens of thousands of ballots over and over and over again, it takes a really long time. And these officials aren't going to be able to start that process until on election day, meaning that count could potentially, before we get a final count of those votes, it could take days in some of those battleground states.
Yeah, there's also something else. So Wisconsin,
There was an appeals court recently that ruled that any ballot received after Election Day won't be counted, regardless of when it was postmarked. And that ruling is now being taken up by the Supreme Court right now. But what's the rationale and what's the sense of how the Supreme Court might view this?
It's really hard to say. You know, we had a similar case in April in the primary in Wisconsin where we had a similar ruling from a lower judge that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court found in that case in the primary that ballots had to be postmarked by Election Day, but they could be counted if they were received a few days after Election Day. But the court has also rejected other changes that would lean more towards ballot access this year, like a witness requirement in South Carolina. So it's a little unclear at this point which way this is going to go. But the bottom line is that the Supreme Court is going to play a big role in a lot of these swing states in different cases. And that also could mean some confusion for voters. You think about Wisconsin voters who are going to be mailing back their ballots still, mm-hmm. you know, 2 or 3 weeks before Election Day, not sure what exactly when they have to get it there for it to count, because that could potentially change.
Yeah, which means they're, I mean, we've heard from people who are saying they're just voting in person because of all of this. So on one hand, they want to practice social distancing and make sure their vote gets counted. That's why they're voting early. But there's also these really long lines we're seeing in places like Georgia where people have waited for hours to vote. Can you remind us what the situation was there and if long lines and waits are something we're going to see throughout this election season?
Yeah, I mean, so what we've seen in Georgia over the last past couple of days as early voting has kicked off has been these reports of these astronomical waits in some places. A lot of social media posts have been getting a lot of traction talking about waits of, you know, 8 hours, 7 hours in some cases. In most cases, it's been less than that, but there have been real waits across the state. You know, in most cases, 1 to 2 to 3 hours. I checked this morning. They have a lot of the counties have ways that you can check and actually look at how long the lines are at individual precincts. The bottom line is that lines are to be expected this election season for a number of reasons. One, you know, we're expecting historic turnout. Two, with the social distancing and the cleaning that's required because of the pandemic, that means voting especially in Georgia, where they're using these electronic machines, may take a little bit longer between individual voters. And also lines, you know, you have to kind of ask yourself a couple questions when you see a long line photo, because in some cases that could be a really long wait. In some cases, you know, social distancing can mean that a line of 40 or 50 people, which in normal times would be normal and maybe within a building, might wrap around a city block or something like that. So there's a lot of things that can contribute to these long lines. The bottom line is we're seeing historic voter turnout. And, you know, election officials I've talked to expect some of those lines to dwindle as we get into the early voting season. It's traditional that the first couple of days of early voting are really popular.
Miles Parks, who covers voting for NPR's Washington desk. Miles, thank you so much.
Thank you.
To California now, where the Glass Fire is almost fully contained and thousands of evacuees from communities in the state's North Bay region have now returned home. But many immigrant workers in the Napa Valley say there's another danger. The wildfires have intensified job losses. KQED's Farida Jabala-Romero reports.
In early October, when the Glass Fire was raging, farm worker Carlos Vergara came to this evacuation center at Napa Valley College to see if he could have a place to sleep. He's one of nearly 2,000 fire evacuees Napa County has helped place in hotel rooms rather than shelters due to the pandemic. But Vergara says the hotel told him he had to leave tomorrow, and there's still no electricity or running water at the farm worker center where he lives back in Calistoga. It's one of many challenges right now for Vergara, a longtime vineyard worker. It's harvest season, but jobs have disappeared after wildfires and smoke damaged grapes, he says.
So we have different types of gift cards depending on what the client's needs are. So we have a lot of food gift cards.
In downtown Napa, staff at Up Valley Family Centers channel private donations to help evacuees with gas and groceries.
It's just devastating for the community that it's been one thing after another.
Up Valley's executive director, Jenny Ocon, says the pandemic and now wildfires have dealt a financial blow to workers in two vital industries here, agriculture and hospitality. Many of these workers are undocumented.
And in particular, for our immigrant community that is pretty hard hit because often certain members are not eligible for federal benefits.
People were already struggling to make rent in the area, she says. And then the glass fire destroyed more than 250 homes in Napa County alone.
I do think it will displace some families.
That could spell trouble for restaurants, hotels, wineries, and vineyards that rely on low-wage immigrant workers to be competitive, says Sonoma State University economics professor Robert Eiler.
Once they want to hire workers back, they might find a labor market that doesn't have as much supply as they used to.
Eiler estimates that more than 80% of Napa County's economy is connected in some way to tourism or the wine industry. But if people can't find work here...
Other states are opening more quickly, have fewer COVID cases, have fewer fires affecting their agriculture and their hospitality. People might move on.
He says low-wage workers will need more long-term support to hang on, but the pandemic has shrunk local and state budgets. At the evacuation center, restaurant server Yalitza Garcia says she's lost work hours, so she's applying for rental assistance from the county. But she'll have to wait, she says, because many others have also applied. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Yavala Romero.
Some liberals have floated the idea of expanding the size of the Supreme Court, packing the court, if Republicans get President Trump's nominee Amy Coney Barrett confirmed before Election Day and they get the Senate. Earlier this week, though, Joe Biden relented to reporters' questions and said he's not a fan of court packing. But it's worth remembering that the High Court hasn't always been nine justices. There have been other attempts, some successful, to alter its size based on politics. And the most famous example of court packing, happened under FDR's watch in the 1930s, and it failed, and it might offer a cautionary tale worth hearing in this week. Kristen McMahon is president of the Robert H. Jackson Center in Jamestown, New York. Jackson served in several posts in FDR's administration. He ended up on the Supreme Court himself. So what happened? Kristen, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much, Robin. It's great to be here.
Let's give some context. This was all in the 1930s during the Depression, worst economy the country's ever seen. FDR soundly trounced Herbert Hoover, who thought the market would just fix things. That's why they called the homeless encampments Hoovervilles. FDR beat him by a landslide, thought maybe he had a mandate, and began pushing through these programs to help the average American. This was, of course, his New Deal. And the Supreme Court began striking down more programs than ever in history?
Yes, it was what we would call a conservative bench and tended to be more pro-business. At least that was certainly the argument. And so a lot of the social reforms, especially, or reforms in favor of workers, were not finding much favor with the court.
So Franklin Delano Roosevelt proposed the Judicial Procedures Reform Bill of 1937. To do what? What did he suggest doing through that program?
What he suggested was that for each justice over the age of 70, that a new justice would be added to the court. And at the time, in 1937, there were six justices over the age of 70. So that would have added, if the bill had been approved, an additional six justices to the court, bringing the court to a total of 15.
Well, and as we mentioned, he thought he had a mandate. I actually don't know what he thought how people would respond, but they hated this. The general public hated it.
They really did. And certainly the news articles at the time are not in favor. Most of the senators seemed to not be in favor, but he had also kept this plan very close to the vest. And so when he announced it in February of 1937, there had been very few people who were aware that this was brewing. And so that also played against him. I think, to your point, that he thought Congress, the Senate, would go along with him pretty easily, given how handily he was elected. And that proved not to be the case.
Right. Congress never voted on FDR's plan to enlarge the Supreme Court, but they didn't have to. At least one justice started to shift. He began supporting these programs, ruling in favor of Social Security, the National Labor Relations Act. And, it so kind of saved the day. There's a saying, I guess, switch in time that saved nine, saved the court at nine because this justice started to vote for the New Deal. And FDR packed the court the old-fashioned way. He ended up naming 9 justices, including Robert Jackson, as others left because of their old age. So talk a little bit about Robert Jackson and his role in all of this.
FDR had attempted to do some things prior to this attempt at court packing. So in 1932, there had been a law passed that actually cut the Supreme Court justices' retirement salary in half. And so that was actually also a reason why none of the justices were retiring. So in 1935, FDR first tried to pass a bill that restored the full retirement salaries, but that failed. And so that's really part of what led to the 37 attempt to pack the court. Jackson at this time is the Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust and actually became one of the main advocates for the plan and said that basically it was a constitutional imperative for justices to be added to the court in order to rebalance what was happening.
What should we take from this today, Kristen McMahon? When we hear about public rejection of packing a court as they did then, adding justices to change the balance, even today, if Democrats feel they were robbed of a justice because Mitch McConnell would not consider Merrick Garland, what should we take from that recent history about whether or not that's a good idea?
Well, you know, as we started off this conversation, you're right that the size of the Supreme Court has never been static. And one quote that Jackson made during a late February 1937 discussion with FDR, and I think it's in a letter that he had written to him, said that the people are unquestionably ready to support you to the finish if they understand that this is a fight to make the court a contemporary and nonpartisan institution. And I find that an interesting thought for this time. You know, would the public feel the same way if that were the rationale for changing the makeup of the court?
Well, we may or may not see. Kristen McMahon, president of the Robert H. Jackson Center in Jamestown, New York. Kristen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin, for having me. This has been a treat.
And we'd love your thoughts at hearnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.